This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
We just need a strategy, okay?
Okay, here's the plan.
The biggest news story of the weekend that nobody is talking about. We go there now on Tactics. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Tactics. It is great to be with you again. For those of you who don't know, I'm Caleb Colquitt, back with you on this Monday morning, and I do have something quite serious to discuss with you this morning. There is a huge, huge news story that I think has gone almost criminally underreported. I want to start out by asking, what would you expect had you walked into a church yesterday? Now, I know that many, many of you in my audience did, in fact, walk into a church yesterday. But what are the kinds of things that you would expect, a church that's unfamiliar to you, a church that you don't regularly attend? What would you expect to see walking into a church yesterday? Pews, a pulpit, microphones, maybe the emblems of the Lord's Supper, a cross, some kind of decoration, stained glass windows maybe, something depicting Christ or some of the other scenes in the Bible. I want you to keep all that in mind. Maybe since many churches celebrate Christmas as the birth of Christ, and because Christmas is only a week away, you would expect to see some kind of Christmas decoration, a nativity scene, maybe a Christmas tree of some kind. Maybe you would expect to see the set for a play about the nativity story, something like that. All those things would be things that we would expect to see in a church had we walked into just a random church the other day. Now imagine you see some of those things when you walk in, but you also see shrapnel, splinters, large chunks of wood, parts of chairs that were used to compensate for the crowds, plastic like lawn chairs scattered everywhere because you had a few extra people this close to Christmas. And then you notice something far more disturbing. Blood, burning flesh, body parts. Unfortunately, this is a real scene. This isn't a hypothetical. This is the reality for the Christians at a church in Quetta, Pakistan. Yesterday, when you walked into their church, it looked more like a scene out of Marvel's The Punisher or an episode of The Sopranos. It didn't look like a church that we would normally think of, what we would expect to see walking into it yesterday morning. Because what happened yesterday is two suicide bombers went into the church and tried to harm the people that were worshiping there. The Islamic State group has claimed responsibility for this devastating attack, which killed 9 people and wounded about 57. Among the victims, 3 of the dead were women, and several of the wounded were women and children. So unfortunately, they accomplished their mission. Luckily, the church did have security, and that security was able to kill one of the bombers before he got inside. So thank goodness that they were able to stop them, that this attack, they said, could have been much, much worse had the second bomber been able to detonate inside. So thankfully, they were able to stop that, and the only people that were killed were the ones that were killed by the one bomber that made it past security. This is actually a very common practice for churches in the Middle East. The attacks have gotten so bad that just about any church in any city of significant size over in that part of the world has to have a couple of armed guards outside to take care of threats like this one. This is, unfortunately, not something that's nearly as uncommon as you might think that it would be. The attacks have been ratcheted up so much in that part of the world because it is so volatile and because there are so many people that hate Christians that this is normal for Christians to have armed security guards, sometimes provided by the local government, the police officers, sometimes paid for privately because that's the only way they can get it. And this is the reality of what they have to go through each and every Sunday when they go to worship. One of the things that I was curious about and thought about almost immediately is the difference in the level of coverage between this story and stories like it. When the Charleston shooting, you remember the one that took place with the white supremacist who wanted to kill a bunch of black people and so went to a predominantly black congregation and killed nine. And the Sutherland Springs shooting that just happened recently, it ate headlines for weeks. For weeks, that was all people were talking about. We were talking about it on this program, the national news. That was at least for 2 weeks, and then going into getting some coverage in the third and fourth week. So almost a month with both of those church shootings, we had several headlines. Even with the, I think, also criminally underreported shooting right outside of Nashville, it at least got headlines for about a week. But I was going through the news last night, and the only news source that I could find that had this as one of their top stories was the Associated Press. That was it. And this happened yesterday morning. ABC News, Fox News, CNN, Washington Post, New York Times, none of them thought this was worthy of their homepage. And I got to thinking, why is that? Why is it that we put so much emphasis on the shootings that happen here, but then these stories happening in the Middle East are, we see almost a new church shooting virtually every month. Some kind of shooting or bombing or some kind of terrorist action that happens against Christians over in the Middle East. And so I thought about that and I thought, why is there such a difference between the level of coverage that each one gets? And we're going to try to answer that question when we come back.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
The general principles on which the fathers achieve independence were the general principles of Christianity. John Adams.
Welcome back, everyone. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and newsradio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers. At Tactics Radio is the Twitter handle. If you want to tweet me, you can do that as well. We sometimes read those on the air. Getting back to the story that we were talking about, where these two suicide bombers and the Islamic State has claimed responsibility, where this attack killed nine people and wounded 57 there in Pakistan. The AP, like I said, was the only news source that I saw that actually had it on their homepage. And you think about it, there are some similarities between these stories. Now, in the case of Sutherland Springs, for example, you had religious extremism. You had a guy who, by all accounts that we can tell, was a very militant atheist and had a problem with Christians and Christians within his own family, going to this church in particular to attack and kill Christians. And in a similar way, we have these two suicide bombers that are religious extremists for Islam, that because their religion teaches them to hate Christians as they see it, they go after innocent people. Why did we cover the attacks here more than the attacks there? I think that there is some level of relatability, and the people in the news media know that. They know that Americans, as a general rule, sadly, part of the reason that their coverage was lacking there, not the only reason, but part of the reason that their coverage was lacking there when it compared to church shootings that happen here stateside and on our own soil, they know that it gets more attention. And they know that that's because people care about it more, they relate to it more, when the victims are people that are more like them. The people who died in the Charleston and the Sutherland Springs and the Nashville shootings, those attacks, they were Americans like us that probably had a similar background, spoke the same language, all that kind of thing. But then we go to the question of why that is. Why do we relate more to those people? And why does it seem that we are far more concerned with Christians that die on this particular place or that particular place? Because I do think whether the news media, we all know that there's a liberal bend there if you're looking at it overall. And so you can't expect them to cover it in the same way, but as everyday Americans, as Christians, if we cared about it more, they would cover it more. They would have to, because we would want to know what was going on. And so because they understand that, and because they know that it's not going to get a lot of clicks or get a lot of views, then they know that they have to adjust what they're going to cover. And so that makes sense. I think part of it also goes to this. And I'm going to make a pop culture reference here because I do think that there's a lot of truth to it and it's appropriate. There's that scene in The Dark Knight where the Joker is explaining that if I kill a gangster or a police officer, nobody panics because it's all according to plan. But when I kill a mayor, everybody starts losing their minds because that's not part of the plan. See, there is some level of expectation, I think, and this is truly sad, but it's the way we work psychological. It's part of being a human being, that when there's a church attack like this in the Middle East, because those have become pretty common, because we're aware that that's just the place where terrorism takes place, that it reduces the shock value and it reduces our interest in it because it has become more common. And I think that's really sad that the death of these people, Christians being killed because they are Christians, because they believe in Jesus Christ and because they believe in the power of his blood to save mankind, died because they will not subscribe to the radical version of Islam that these people practice. See, our Christian brothers are being slaughtered in mass specifically because of their beliefs. And this is something that has really affected me. And the actions that took place are indicative of a sinister, wicked ideology that seeks to eradicate all that disagree with them. Christians, atheists, Hebrews, and in many cases, other Muslims that they don't consider Muslim enough. Think about that too. Their hatred goes so deep that they not only hate Christians and hate Jews, but they also hate any Muslim that doesn't hate Christian or Jews. That is an incredibly deep-seated hatred that they just dislike anybody that doesn't dislike those other groups as much as they do. How do we combat an enemy like this? How do we win this fight? Well, there is a passage in Ephesians 6:12 that says, "For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against rulers, against the powers, against the world forces of darkness, against the spiritual forces of wickedness in heavenly places." Obviously, there is a worldly conflict going on. We've been talking about it for the past several minutes. There is a conflict on the geopolitical side of this that has to be fought. And we need to do the best that we can to wipe out people like this that are extremists, that do want to kill in the name of Allah or whatever else, that want to harm innocent people. That's something that cannot be ignored. However, what Paul is saying here in Ephesians is that when it comes to the Christian, the most important struggle for him is not the physical one, not whether he lives or dies, not gaining territory or anything like that here on this side of eternity. Our struggle is against the powers of darkness. And this is about as dark as it gets. So how do we combat this? What do we do spiritually? How do we wage this spiritual warfare? I think it goes back to obedience to the gospel. We have to be the kind of people that follow the scripture no matter what, like these Christians obviously were. Keep in mind, this was not a surprise attack. I mean, it was, but not in the sense that it was not all that surprising. That's part of the reason that it went underreported, because attacks like this have become common in the Middle East. They had armed security there because they know there's a very real risk of somebody doing something like this. And I do want to ask that question of you, because we are waging this spiritual warfare. Here in America, where a church attack is such a big deal that it garners months of discussion on political talk shows, and that's what the public talks about for months on end, how would we react if this were commonplace in America? And goodness knows I pray that it never is. But if we had to have armed security at every single door because we know there's a really good chance some maniac is going to try to blow us up just because we're worshiping there, would we still attend that worship service? I mean, sometimes it's hard enough to get people to church in football season. If every church in America were filled to its absolute capacity, less than 5% of the American population would be at church that Sunday. Now, that's about a 5 or 6 year old statistic. I don't know if it's true. It may be worse now. I'm not sure. But that is staggering. We have a hard time getting out of bed in the morning because we're tired on Sunday morning, and these guys are going into a church that they know somebody could strap a bomb to himself and try to blow them up just because they're there to pray and worship with their fellow believers. It takes incredible faith to do that every single day, every single Sunday, and to live out your life knowing that at any time somebody could try to kill you just because of what you believe. Well, it is a true testament to their faith. And I pray that when tested, if tested, I hope it never becomes that way in America, but if it does, that we would not be found wanting. This is how we're going to wage the spiritual battle, by being those people. By obeying the gospel no matter what happens. Nothing makes a fake ideology like Islam look more fake than comparing it to the real thing. When you're looking at one side, which straps bombs to themselves and blows themselves up to attack the other side, and the other side that stands there and embraces everybody, helps people, does the right thing, works hard, lives a good life. That's what's going to win this spiritual warfare for us. Take it away, Rush.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt. Every weekday from 9 to 11, only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.
Philippians 3:20, for our citizenship is in heaven, from which also we eagerly wait for a Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ.
Hey everybody, welcome back. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers if you want to weigh in. You can also tweet at Tactics Radio if you want to get in touch with me that way. So let's go ahead and jump to the GOP tax bill, because they are expecting this to pass this week. It's important to know what's in it, what all it means, what it could mean for you, where it came from. So in looking at this, we really need to really fully appreciate the context and how this whole thing has evolved in this whole debate. I just want to real quickly take you through a review of what was in each of the tax bills, very briefly kind of give you an overview of how this thing has progressed since it started a few months ago when we started talking about doing something about the tax proposals. So the current tax code, just so you know, is 7 different brackets, ranging from 10% at the lowest to 39.6% at the highest. There's a lot of complicated deductions, which is part of the reason that the GOP has promised to reduce that, simplify it, and the corporate tax rate is currently 35%. So that's the starting point. That is where we are right now. If the GOP doesn't pass anything, that is our current tax code. That is what it will remain if nothing is done. Then later on, we saw Donald Trump put forward and issue his statement. Now, the White House can't make policy. It can't write policy. It can't write bills. It can make suggestions just to give Congress an idea of the kind of thing it would like to see. But the president has no legislative authority. He can only sign bills into law or veto them and then enforce them. So his proposal that he put forward to the GOP was three brackets with a possible fourth and 12% to 35%. And there was a slight deduction on, there was a slight rollback on the deductions, the things that you take out. There were some proposals that it had there to take away some of those deductions, and the corporate tax rate was going to be a flat 20%. Now, a lot of people are crying foul because of the massive drop in the corporate tax rate, but it is important to keep in mind that we are by far, not even close, the highest corporate tax rate in the world. The average is somewhere around 22%. We're at 35%. So 20% would put us just barely under the world average. And it would help to make us far more competitive. So that was the original tax proposal put out by the White House. After getting that, the House started taking a look at it, going through it, and then proposed their own version of the tax bill, which, by the way, did pass, which had four to five tax brackets. They had four that they were set, and then they had the possibility of a fifth one. So one more than the Trump tax proposal, ranging from 12 to 37%, so a little bit higher than Trump's version. Even less deductions rolled back, with a couple of new ideas thrown in there. And then the corporate tax rate still at 20%. And then, of course, it went on to Congress, went on to the Senate. The Senate took a look at it, and that is what we are looking at right now. The Senate went back and forth and had a couple different proposals. The current one that we're looking at right now, the one that we're saying may pass this week, seven tax brackets, so no reduction in brackets at all. Exactly the same amount of brackets as we have currently, which range from 10%, which it was already at, to 37%. So basically what happened, and if you're looking at the seven tax brackets, is they basically, there's a couple of exceptions here, but the general rule is every tax bracket went down by about 2%. Even less deductions are getting rolled back, and the corporate tax rate would be at 21%. So a little bit higher, one percentage point higher than the House's bill. Now, one interesting thing that the Senate version of the bill does do, which is a step in the right direction, is it would also repeal the individual mandate. So the individual mandate that comes along with Obamacare that says people must get health insurance, it is against the law for you to not have health insurance, that is part of that part would be repealed if this tax bill goes through as is. Now, we don't know, that could get taken out, it could not get taken out, we're not sure, but right now, it looks as though that may have the votes to pass, so that would be a good thing. But interestingly enough, and unless the coverage that I'm seeing of this has just left it out, it does not repeal the death tax, which Trump's original plan repealed the death tax, the House plan repealed the death tax. I do not understand why the Senate bill doesn't get rid of the death tax. Or if it does, maybe it does, and nobody's reported on that, but it seems like something that significant, they would have talked about it. So it seems as though the death tax is being left alone by the Senate version of the bill. So do you see the problem here? Do you see what's going on? Do you see why this is problematic? We started at a very weak place. We barely tinkered and fiddled around the edges with the original tax proposal. The White House went in with a very mild change to the tax code. Now, that is not the change that Donald Trump campaigned on. Donald Trump campaigned on a plan with three brackets across the board at 10, I believe it was 10, 15, and 25. was the original proposal. Now, that changed a little bit over the campaign and got adjusted here and there, so I don't want to give a definite, you can look me up on that. But that would have been a really significant tax cut for everybody in America. Really significant tax cut. And that was Donald Trump's original plan. Not ideal, not one that I like. I don't like the idea of tax brackets or any kind of progressive tax anyway. That comes directly out of the Communist Manifesto. You don't believe me, you can look it up. We are literally currently living under a progressive tax system which was designed and thought up by Karl Marx. So, you know, congratulations, America. But anyway, that aside, you see what the problem is here? We're basically back to square one. The new Senate proposal only decreases each tax bracket, doesn't get rid of any of the brackets, keeps all seven brackets, just gets rid of each tax bracket by just 2%. So barely a tax cut. You'll get to keep 2% more of your money. Yay. Thanks, government. Good job. I get to keep 2% of the money that I make. Awesome. Now, the only thing that has remained consistent, and this is good, I'm not trying to downplay this at all, because this really will help the economy. The corporate tax coming down is going to be a major boon to the economy. But other than that, I mean, they even apparently aren't doing anything about the death tax now, which wouldn't have made a massive economic impact. I was just more worried about it from the moral implications, but they're not reducing that many deductions. They're not reducing your tax rate all that much. And so this is a really big problem because we're not really changing all that much. We're not doing a whole lot. And so, honestly, I understand the frustration here. Because this is not the radical change that people thought that Donald Trump was going to bring, that putting Republicans in the House and the Senate was going to bring back when Obama was there. And their complaint was, well, we can't do anything about taxes because Obama's going to veto it. Well, finally, we got the House, we got the Senate, we got the White House. We have given Republicans absolutely everything that they've asked for, and the best that they can do is give us 2% off the top. That's it? Really? Now, don't get me wrong. It's an improvement. It is a step in the right direction where I, sitting in Congress, goodness knows that was a scary thing to think about. If I were sitting in Congress and I were Senator Colquitt or Representative Colquitt, I'd probably vote for this because it is a step in the right direction. It'll help a little bit. But come on, really, GOP? This is the best you can do? You know, there's a good chance you're going to lose the House based on what we've been seeing lately politically in the next election. You'll probably retain the Senate. But there's a good shot you're going to lose the House, which means any kind of bill that affects spending would have to originate from the House. Is this really what you want your legacy to be? Is this the best that you can do? Because it's going to be really hard to motivate Republicans to get out and vote for you when they gave you the House, they gave you the Senate, they gave you the White House, they gave you absolutely everything that you wanted, and you give them 2% off the top, which could, you know, go back in the other direction when the Democrats take over. Good job, Republicans. This is why people get frustrated with you guys, and this is why the GOP is having a real hard time selling this tax bill. And I'm going to get into that and the political reasons why they've had a really hard time selling this to the American public and helping them understand why this would be a good idea. We will get there when we come back. Before I do go, though, I want to tell you about my good friends at Southside Firestone Tire and Auto Center. These guys have been in business for 50 years right here in Montgomery. There's a good reason for that. They know what they're doing. They've been doing it for 50 years, and the reason that they've been able to stay here is because they offer great service at a great price. You walk into their door, you tell them what's wrong with the car or the truck that you've brought in, they give it a once-over, they tell you exactly what needs to be done, and then they ask you how you want to proceed. You're in charge. They're not trying. They don't just do repairs and say, hey, this is how much it's going to cost. They let you make the decision. They let you make the call. They put you in charge, and that's why people have been going there for 50 years, and they trust them. Because they treat you like the owner of the car. What a novel idea that is. So when you have an investment like this, I mean, this is probably the second biggest investment you have other than your house, and your car needs to be in top peak peak condition to be able to keep your family safe. Goodness knows there's going to be a lot of travel going on this holiday. You don't want to be stuck on the side of the road with a bunch of presents in the back seat and your family can't get to grandma's house or wherever it is you need to go. So go by, talk to my friends at Woodham Southside Firestone Tire and Auto Center. No matter what it is you need for any of your car's needs, any repairs, anything you might need, an oil change, a tune-up, whatever, be sure to get that done so you're not stuck on the side of the road at Woodham Southside Firestone Tire and Auto Center on the Troy Highway. Go see them today. We will be right back.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast. This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
As to Jesus of Nazareth, my opinion of whom you particularly desire, I think the system of morals in his religion, as he left them to us, the best the world ever saw or is likely to see. Benjamin Franklin.
Welcome back, everybody. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers if you want to weigh in. Also, you can tweet me at Tactics Radio. The GOP is having a hard time selling this bill both to its base and to the general population. And I can see why. This is a pretty good bill had it been made in 2009-2010. If the Democrats, who at the time controlled the House and the Senate, and you had Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi and Barack Obama all coming up with this tax plan, I would have been ecstatic. A 2% tax cut in a House, Senate, and White House, all controlled by Democrats, would have been a massive victory. But when you've got the GOP, who claims to believe in the economics of letting the American people hang on to their own money and make the economy better on their own, who claim to subscribe to that belief, are saying, yeah, we're going to cut it by 2%. Well, yeah, I understand why they're having a hard time selling that to the American people. This is not something that you would expect to come out of a Republican House and a Republican Senate. So why is the GOP having this massive, massive problem selling this bill? There's a few things. First of all, it is way too complicated. The House bill was over 400 pages. This bill is now over 1,000 pages, and it keeps all seven brackets. So it's hard for people to even understand what their taxes are going to look like based on this bill. You've got to go through all the mental gymnastics of trying to figure out exactly how this tax bill will affect you. There's way too much text for the average person to read. I got to tell you, I really liked Mo Brooks' proposal, which is that thing that he wrote, I don't know, a couple of years back. I mean, that was the Obamacare repeal, but my point is his bill was only about a sentence long. That's the kind of bill that we need to be looking at. I'm not saying that it has to be necessarily that short, but a proposal that the average American can look at and read and understand. This is something that would go a very, very long way in selling this bill, because then the bill would rise or fall on its own merits. And people like tax cuts. Even people who typically vote Democrat really like tax cuts. And so even if they've been taught their entire life that it's bad to allow rich people to keep their own money, even if they understood that, if they were looking at their own taxes and saying, I'm going to bring home $1,000 more next year based on this tax proposal, you know what? They may be willing to accept that. They may not like the fact that at the top, the bill lets rich people keep their own money. I know letting people keep their own money, what a novel concept that is. But they may not like that, but even Democrat voters could at least get on board with getting a tax cut themselves. But it's so minuscule that they're having a hard time selling this to the American people. And with 1,000 pages, people don't even know if they're actually going to be bringing home more money. It's too convoluted. And so if they really want to be able to sell this bill to the American people, they got to simplify it. Also, a measly 2% cut for people and a 14% tax cut for corporations it's easy to make the case when that's what you're looking at, that Republicans care more about rich people and corporations than they do about the average person. I'm not saying that's true. I'm not saying that it's fair. I'm saying that it is easy to make that argument when you're looking at a 14% decrease in the corporate tax cut and everybody else is just getting a little 2% across the board. Deep tax cuts, massive tax reform. Then you can make the case that this is really something for the middle class. The average voter doesn't believe that because they're getting very little out of it while corporations are getting a big jump forward. Not saying that corporations shouldn't get a really big tax cut. I'm in favor of the corporate tax cut. That's the best thing about this bill. I'm just saying that it is harder to make the case to the American people that you are on their side when you've got this really, really big tax cut for corporations and a very, very tiny one for them. Furthermore, the primary goal was remaining deficit neutral, not delivering a decent tax cut. See, that's been their goal through this whole thing. Well, we want to decrease taxes, but we don't want to decrease the amount of money that the government is actually bringing in. First of all, that's never happened in the history of mankind. Every single time we cut taxes, you look a couple years later, our revenues actually go up. We're actually bringing in more money because we've increased the amount of taxpayers by improving the economy. And this is not just a Republican thing. Happened with Clinton, happened with JFK. Tax cuts do result in revenue boost. However, let's just pretend that it doesn't. Why is this something that scares Republicans so much? Less money coming into the government means more money staying out there in the economy. That's a good thing. The fact that some government programs that are non-essential anyway might have to get cut, that also is a good thing. This is something that Republicans claim to believe. They say, well, we want smaller government. We want to reduce the size of government. Well, then why are you so afraid of reducing the amount of money that comes in? If you have a smaller government, you don't need as much money. This is why people think Republicans don't really believe what they say they believe, because they don't show it. Republicans legislate as if they don't believe in their own ideology. They look timid and afraid and almost apologetic for their ideas. And that's one of the things that kind of rubs people the wrong way. They can tell that they're not really on board with it. And that's something that bothers them. You see, Republicans are like salespeople that don't use their own product. They're like a door-to-door salesman selling vacuums, and none of them actually own that vacuum because they don't believe in their own product. People can pick up on that. They can tell that you don't really believe what you're saying. And their media appearances give off that same sort of apologetic vibe. Republicans simply have to believe in their product. They have to believe in their own ideas. If they had faith that small government and low taxes was a better way to live, their legislation would reflect that. And this legislation doesn't. That's how you make the case to the American people. Tell them boldly, yes, this is going to increase revenues. Yes, this is going to make the economy better. And we're going to be the ones that get the credit for it. Hour two coming up.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt. Every weekday from 9 to 11. Only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.
We just need a strategy, okay?
Okay, here's the plan.
Things are not looking good for Venezuela, as a New York Times report shows. We go there now on Tactics. Welcome back, everybody. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and the News Radio 1440 app. 860-1440 are the numbers at Tactics Radio. That is my Twitter handle. So if you want to get in touch with me, well, that would be the way to do it. We're going to talk about this new article that has come out in the New York Times. It's a pretty lengthy report, but well worth the read. They did an undercover investigation which included doctors in 21 public hospitals across the 17 states of Venezuela, looking at what their job looks like, some of the cases that they've been taking to see how bad the economic crisis in Venezuela has been. All have reported children coming in with severe malnutrition overwhelming their ERs. So the way that that works is their ERs that they have set up, they're saying that now they're so full, so overcrowded with kids, and a lot of those cases are not illnesses, not viruses or anything like that. It's malnutrition. The status has gotten so bad that there are these kids literally starving to death that are coming to their door, and there's not a whole lot that they can do for them at this point. 63% of those hospitals report having no baby formula at all. Now think about that. A hospital that delivers babies, having these kids come in, not having any formula or food to offer them whatsoever. That is an astounding statistic found by this New York Times report. One doctor has reported requesting 193 essential medications. This year he's gotten 4. So over the course of a year, 193 medications that he requested to try to get for his hospital, he's only been able to receive 4 of them from the government. They've had to scrounge around. They lack basic supplies like soap, syringes, latex gloves, gauze, diapers, all of these things that we take for granted here that are just commonplace. Basic medical supplies these hospitals are not able to obtain. One child was so malnourished that in the story that they were telling about this one individual kid that they had been following, that when they embalmed him after he passed away from starvation, his spine and his rib cage protruded. That's how bad this kid was, that his skeleton was just sinking in. His flesh was basically latching onto his bones because of how malnourished he was when he passed. It's a really horrible thing to picture and to think about. But this is the reality for the people of Venezuela. This is something that they have to deal with every single day. They had 12 different patients with this one doctor that they were following one particular day. 4 of them were kids that came in with malnutrition. So a third of his patients on this particular day that they happened to be following him around were kids that just didn't have enough to eat. Unfortunately, this is the reality for them, and this is commonplace. This is not something that just affects kids. Of course, that was kind of the focus of the article. But in Venezuela, there are riots over food shortages. These are common. There are lines for basic commodities like beans, toilet paper. They say you can wait in line for 2 to 3 hours for a can of beans. But people are willing to do it because it's better than having nothing. Soldiers are actually stationed outside bakeries and grocery stores in Venezuela to protect the people inside from the people outside. They have to keep soldiers in place to maintain order. Food is either incredibly expensive or out of stock. So the government does give these little white ration boxes to families, but it's just not enough. They're not able to sustain a family based off of this measly amount of food that they've been able to give out. Crowd storm dumpsters of restaurants after they close. Can you imagine that? Something like that happening here? That after a restaurant closes, you have a crowd trying to get into the dumpster behind a restaurant so that they might be able to find some food? It's incredible what they're going through right now. And then they have roaming street gangs, mostly of young boys, some as young as 8 or 9, that go around fighting each other for territory. When I say fighting for territory, I don't mean territory to commit crimes or anything like that, like we would think of gang crime. They want territory to go dumpster diving, to find food, to find scraps, to panhandle, to beg. And that's why they get into these large knife fights with other gangs to try to protect their turf. It's an incredibly desperate situation, and it really breaks my heart to read some of this. And the government has tried and done its best and done actually a pretty good job. This is one of the few things that their government has been able to do efficiently at keeping these statistics from getting out, from this getting out into the national media, or the international media, sorry. They've tried to cover it up with a near blackout of all health stats, but when these health stats do come out, they're pretty staggering. Looking at everything that they've been unable to provide for their people. Now, the military has been put in charge of all bulletins. This is how deep this blackout goes. Now think about that. That would mean that, for example, statistics that we're getting from the CDC, none of those things can be approved without the Army giving their okay on it. I mean, obviously, it would be the Venezuelan equivalent to those two things, but you get what I'm saying, how crazy that is, that they've put the military in charge of it because they're afraid of bad press getting out. One of the reports that this New York Times article uses was quickly taken off the website and claimed that the website had been hacked. They said, no, that didn't happen. And then all the officials that were involved in posting that somehow mysteriously went missing. That's weird. It all just kind of vanished at the same time. The person that was at the head of the department that posted that bulletin, for example, he just mysteriously died right after that. Weird how that took place. But the military is now in charge of all bulletins, and nothing gets in or out of Venezuela information-wise without the military knowing about it. So an incredibly desperate situation. It's amazing what has been going on there. I've been monitoring this for a while, and for the New York Times to put this out was really surprising to me, but something that it was encouraging that they've, because they haven't really reported on it a whole lot. They have mentioned it here in passing over the past several months. I mean, this crisis has been going on for 3 years. One thing that was staggering to me is that inflation could reach 2,300% this year. It actually reminded me of the Weimar Republic, which happened right before World War II in Nazi Germany, before the rise of Hitler. That's what was going on in Germany, is that you had the Germans would have the mark, which was their currency at the time, and they would have hyperinflation to where people would be rolling in literally wheelbarrows of money to buy a loaf of bread from a grocery store. That's how bad it had gotten in Germany back then. It's kind of the same thing here. Hyperinflation has completely destroyed any of the savings or any of the equity that was built up by these families, because they still have, they have more money than they've ever had. It's just not worth anything. So think about that. 2,300%. That's a lot to happen in a single year. The inflation rate, think about your money being that much less valuable from January to December. We're almost at the end of a year. Imagine that your money was worth that much in January. It's now worth basically nothing, barely worth the paper that it's printed on. And to put that into perspective, how much this has changed, a month of baby formula cost about 2 months' salary on average in Venezuela. So this hyperinflation has really hit families hard. To buy just a month, you would have to work for 2 months. Obviously, that's unsustainable because that would be just baby formula. That's not counting food for your family or rent or any of the other things. And a 2016 survey by three Venezuelan universities showed that 9 out of 10 homes are food insecure. So 90% of the homes in Venezuela are struggling with hunger right now. Young women are even lining up and opting to be sterilized since there are birth control shortages. So they're having a hard time finding condoms or birth control pills. And because of that, they're just saying, I'll volunteer to be sterilized. And the government's willing to do that operation for them just to try to keep the population down. And women are actually volunteering for this because it's so difficult to provide for and raise children that they'd rather do that than have another kid and have to figure out a way to feed him or her. So an incredibly desperate situation. It's amazing to look at this, and your heart really breaks for the people of Venezuela for what's going on. We're going to look at some of the causes of it and how it could be rectified when we come back.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
John 13:34-35. A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another, even as I have loved you, that you also love one another. By this all men will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers if you want to weigh in. At Tactics Radio is my Twitter handle. Let's go ahead and jump to the phones right now. Let's go to John from Millbrook on line one. Good morning.
Good morning. Let me make a prediction on this, and I would like for you to follow up on the story that you're addressing.
Okay.
I would tend to think that what's going to happen is one of these maniacal, unfeeling, imperialist, capitalistic governments is the ones going to have to pull them out of this mess.
Yeah,
like the United States.
Yeah, you're probably right. What's going on right now in Venezuela is actually that the government has officially refused all aid or of any kind, and saying that there is no problem, there's no humanitarian crisis. The United States and other countries have actually offered aid to help the people of Venezuela, and they've turned it down and said no.
Now, why would they do that?
Well, there's a lot of different people speculating on that. I think it goes back to, if they do admit that there's a humanitarian crisis, they would be admitting that their policies failed, that their government isn't working.
Mm-hmm.
And so because of their own pride and arrogance, they're willing to let their people starve to death for it.
Right. And that's a sad situation, because those that have to endure, I would tend to think that, and I don't know how you would go about researching this, but the idea that is going on right now, there's class warfare going on with the Democrats talking about the tax policy and that kind of thing. I would tend to think that you've got probably about 1% of their population that's enjoying about 95% of their wealth.
Oh, well, that's how it always is. The thing is, they always talk about capitalism being greedy and imperialistic. And,
right.
But at the end of the day, every single socialist government that's ever existed exists to provide for the ruling class every
right.
single time. You think Stalin ever wanted anything in his life that there was something he couldn't
Not
do?
Not hardly.
Chairman Mao, I mean, it doesn't. Well, you can even use a smaller example. The Castro brothers, their family. They all get exactly what they need and what they want. They get the best health care in the world. It's everybody else that pays for it.
I think the difference in our system and their system is that we do have a genuine opportunity to reach that level of elite if we do the right things and work hard enough and have some luck and blessing and all of that, whereas they can't at all.
Right, and that's,
their underclass will never make it.
And that's the difference, which is so funny, because the people who are on the left, they talk about upward mobility. There is no upward mobility in socialism. There is the peasants, and there is the ruling class, and that's it. You're either one or the other. And the odds of you jumping from one to the other, not real high, because there's not too many of the elites.
That's right.
All right.
Just wanted to weigh in on that. Take care.
Yeah, thank you so much for your call. I appreciate it. No, it was a great call, and what you're talking about, the reason that they will not accept help, they actually do address that in this New York Times article. This is close to the end of the article, but I got to give the New York Times credit. They typically tend to lean left, and they, you know, usually are not exactly the champions of free market capitalism, but props to the New York Times for posting this and putting this in their article, even if it is all the way at the bottom. This is a quote directly from them. The suffering of the Venezuelan families is expected to worsen next year. Beyond the IMF's warning that inflation could surpass 2,300%, observers worry that the leftist government will continue to refuse international aid for political reasons. Quote, if they accept the help, they accept that there is a humanitarian crisis here and officially recognize that their population is vulnerable, and just how much their policies have failed them, end quote, said Susan Raffi, a specialist on food emergencies who consults for the Cartillas in Venezuela. The Venezuelan government has used food services to keep the socialists in power, critics say, Before the recent elections, people living in government housing projects say they were visited by representatives of their socialist community councils. The government-aligned groups that organized the delivery of boxes of cheap food and threatened with being cut off if they did not vote for the government. So there you have it. You vote for us or you go hungry. Your family doesn't eat unless you vote in favor of our policies and our people. Think about that. That's political extortion if there ever was one. This is what socialism looks like. This is the face of communism. Everything we've talked about is what happens when socialism is fully embraced. Keep in mind, in Venezuela, food, work, having a job, all rights in Venezuela. You have a right to all those things. And yet so many people don't have them. Treating things as rights does not make them magically appear. The government doesn't say, okay, you have a right to food, and then magically a plate of food arrives in front of your door. That's not how this works. You can make things like food and healthcare a right, but that doesn't mean that those things are magically going to appear. This is what always happens in social government. They promise the moon, but they never can deliver. Eventually, the economy collapses because you run out of other people's money. They have, the country of Venezuela, they have the most proven oil reserves on earth. This is not because they're a poor company like, or a poor country that can't provide for itself. This is not the issue. They have amazing natural resources. Back before socialism set in, this was one of the most prosperous economies in the world. And now their people are waiting for 3 hours in line for a can of beans. This is what socialism looks like. One of the first things that Chavez did, take over the oil industry. One of the first things that he did. Because he knew that this is what Marxism is. You have to take over the economy. And so he started taking over what was the biggest money maker and completely destroyed it. The price of oil sunk, so they couldn't mask the economic crisis anymore. We learned that everything is much worse in Venezuela than people originally thought. Isn't it ironic that the left hates oil and talks about how evil oil is, and yet the only thing that keeps them afloat even for a little while is having a lot of oil? Even though this isn't really, they've gotten so upset by Americans referring to them as the as a socialist country that they've talked about, the Prime Minister of Denmark came out and said, we are not a socialist economy. But nonetheless, the Denmark's economy, which they are far more progressive than we are. They have heavy graduated taxes. They're far closer to a socialist country than America is. Part of the reason they're able to sustain that is because they produce 20 times more oil per person than America does. So oil is ironically the only thing that kind of keeps socialism afloat for a little while. And yet they refer to it as the greatest evil in the world. So what you're always going to hear from this is, well, yeah, you could use this as an example, but they're not doing socialism the right way. We want democratic socialism. Hugo Chavez was elected by popular vote. I'm sorry, but it's the reality. That's what happened. Hugo Chavez was a popular person. His ideas of socialism were popular amongst the people, and they voted him in democratically. His policies were popular. They wanted him to enact socialism, and he did, and this is what happened. Just because you put democracy in front of something doesn't automatically make it good. Furthermore, the same thing happened of Lenin and Chairman Mao. Those guys were elected in a fair democratic election. And their people still starved to death. Just because you voted in a policy doesn't mean it will work. Just because a policy is popular doesn't mean it will work. It can't just defy the laws of basic economics because people said, yeah, that's a good idea, we'll do that. This is the same thing that's happening in Venezuela right now. Hyperinflation also occurred in the Weimar Republic. We were talking about this just a second ago, where people were bringing in giant bags of money, wheelbarrows full of money, just to buy a loaf of bread. This is what they do to try to say, no, look, you're making so much money. Well, yeah, but if you're making $10,000 an hour, that's of little consequence when a loaf of bread is $1 million. inflation doesn't work. It only masks the problem, and these governments keep trying to do it, and it never works. The truth is Venezuela is the rule, not the exception. How many times does socialism have to completely fall on its face before people realize, yeah, this Marxism thing doesn't work. Karl Marx was wrong. His policies don't work. And they'll always say, well, they're not doing socialism right. To anybody that thinks that socialism is this benevolent, well-intentioned social experiment that just hasn't been implemented correctly yet, tell me the policy that Hugo Chavez put in place that you disagree with. Which policy specifically did he enact? Was it taking over the economy? Because that's textbook Marxism. Was it a heavy graduated tax? Was it taking the people's possessions and land for the government? Taking over the companies? Because that's all Marxism. Which policy did he enact that is against, quote unquote, your brand of socialism? This is the problem, and this is the question that nobody can ever seem to answer when I talk to them about this kind of thing. Marxism just does not work, and the reason it doesn't is because it ignores the fundamental truth of human nature. Democracy will always end in a dictatorship. And if you don't believe me, read James Madison in Federalist 10. There's a reason that they did not make us a democracy. We are a republic because in America, the Constitution is the final say. Not a person, not a president, not Congress, not the Supreme Court. The Constitution is the greatest power in our land, a document that is not changed by public opinion. There's a reason for that. There's a reason we're a representative republic. You see, the legacy of socialism is misery, starvation, and ruin, no matter how many times you try it, no matter how many times you put it through its paces, and no matter what situation it happens to be in, it is always going to end up looking like Venezuela every time. It always has. It always will. End of story. History is not on your side, socialist. I'm sorry, but it's just not. Because your ideology is flawed and immoral. And this is proof of it. We'll be back.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt. Every weekday from 9 to 11. Only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.
Righteousness alone can exalt a nation. Patrick Henry.
Welcome back, everybody. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers. If you want to weigh in and let me know what is on your mind this morning, you can also tweet me at Tactics Radio. By the way, did want to bring this up because apparently, according to Alabama News Network, our partners over there, it appears as though Roy Moore has announced that he is going to start the Election Integrity Fund. So what he's going to do is he's going to be raising money to continue the fight after the election is over to try to, I assume that what this money would be used for would be to pay for a recount of the votes. I got to be honest, just looking at this, based on everything that's going on, I don't think it's going to make a difference. I don't think that there's any chance that Roy Moore will be the senator from Alabama instead of Doug Jones. They could recount it. That 1.5% difference is just too much to be overcome, even if you're talking about voter fraud. Now, goodness knows, Secretary of State John Merrill has been relentless in looking into voter fraud. That's his department. And maybe there was some voter fraud. There's usually at least a couple cases of voter fraud in every election, as we found out the last time we interviewed him. But the idea that it's going to make a difference or that Roy Moore is going to be elected, that just doesn't seem to be the case. I do not foresee a possibility where Roy Moore actually won that election. And this is important because if there is a case of voter fraud or something of that nature, we need to know about it. We need to hash that out. By the way, how are you feeling about this? 860-1440, if you want to tell me, is this something you would be interested in? Do you think that Roy Moore should give up the fight, bow out gracefully, that kind of thing? Let me know. 860-1440 would be the way to do that. But looking at this election in hindsight, I just do not believe that there is any way, even if they were able to afford a recount, for that to take place. John Merrill has already said that he doesn't believe that there's going to be any difference made in this, that it's very unlikely that anything will happen that will change the results. Judge Moore, I say this as somebody trying to be friendly and say this as somebody who's trying to give you advice politically for the future. It is in your best interest to go ahead and concede. Seriously. If there's any cases of voter fraud or whatever, those need to be reported. I'm all in favor of going after those. That's something that we need to do because it protects the integrity of our voting system. But especially in the state of Alabama, where we have some of the strictest voter regulation or voter ID laws in the country, I just find it extremely unlikely that you're going to find 20,000 votes, because not only would you need those 20,000 votes, but you would need at least 20,000 votes that were cast in favor of Roy Moore to make a difference. And I just do not see that happening. I'm sorry, but I don't see it. I know that it sucks that Doug Jones is going to be our senator. I've talked about how bad this is with Doug Jones representing a state that basically he will be misrepresenting in a lot of ways Alabama's values, what we believe as a people. I hate that as well. However, I don't see this being productive. If anything, I think that it would be better for Roy Moore in any political future he might have to go ahead, concede the race, and go off into that good night, at least for now. Because hanging on to this, trying to fight a cause that has already lost, so far as I can tell, that doesn't do you any favors politically. And it just makes the Republicans, frankly, look kind of petty and crying over spilled milk. You don't want to be the, I'm not saying that this is the Roy Moore supporters, but you don't want to be like the Hillary supporters were in this past election, where you've got people gathering in New York to shout at the sky because of how frustrated they are that Donald Trump's president. Look, Judge Moore, I hate to say this, it leaves a bad taste in my mouth, but Doug Jones is the senator from Alabama. He won the election fair and square, as much as I may dislike it. It's time to let this thing go. And Secretary of State Merrill is saying that this is just not going to make a difference, and I agree with him. Also wanted to real quickly address something else, because I was having a very interesting discussion with my former co-host the other day, because, as y'all know, we go to church together. And she was talking about how, in her opinion, and a lot of people have this opinion, so I'm just using her as kind of a springboard to have this discussion, that the write-ins were really what made the difference, because the write-ins were larger than the margin of victory that Doug Jones won by. I don't think that's the case, and here's why. In any election, regardless of who the candidates are, you're going to get somewhere around 1% of the write-in vote. At least 1%, generally speaking, writes in regardless of what the election is, whether it's typical or not. Now, there was an unusually high level of that write-in for this particular election, and that is true, and that's something that we should be looking at. But roughly 1% goes to a write-in no matter what the election is. So if you're looking at that, then you have to pretty much give away 1% of that 1.9% of the vote to saying that's just part of the election. So then you've got Roy Moore, who lost by 1.5% with only about 9% of the vote that may or may not have voted for him or defaulted back to the Republican had they voted the other way. But you also have to assume that at least some of those people tended to lean left, probably not many of them. But you can't just necessarily assume that all of that 0.9% would have gone to Roy Moore anyway, and even if they had, he would have still lost. He lost by a larger margin than that. So, to me, the more telling statistic is this. Doug Jones received 94% of the votes that Hillary Clinton did. Roy Moore received 45% of the votes that Donald Trump did. So if you're looking at that and looking at the stakes and looking at how this election unfolded, that was a much bigger factor in this election. The people that stayed home. Because Doug Jones was able to mobilize 94% of the people that came out and voted for Hillary Clinton, which meant, especially in a special election in an off year, that Doug Jones was able to get basically all the Democrats that were ever going to even consider voting to the polls. He only missed 6% of those people. Roy Moore was not able to mobilize those people. He was not able to get people excited for his campaign. He was not able to explain to them the seriousness of what was going on. And unfortunately, the way that politics works in America nowadays, he was not able to convince them that Doug Jones was a much greater danger to the Republic than he was. Ergo, he only got 45% of the votes that Donald Trump did in a deep, deep red state. So if you really want to look at voter-wise how this shook out, the difference maker was not the write-ins. The difference maker was the people who stayed home and didn't vote at all. So that was really the issue, that Roy Moore had a problem because he was such a flawed candidate, mobilizing and exciting the base, or not the base, exciting the regular Republican voters to get out and vote for him. The stay-at-home vote was the far more significant statistic, based on what I can tell, because that would have been thousands upon thousands of more votes in his favor, which he was not able to get. The Democrats were highly motivated. The Republicans simply weren't. And that's what it all boils down to. Chaplin's report is coming up next.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Hebrews 8:10. For this is the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel. After those days, says the Lord, I will put my laws into their minds, and I will write them on their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people.
Welcome back, all. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. We've spoken a lot today about the nature of man. And God designed mankind and the world in a certain way. He designs us in a way where we're to live and operate around certain natural laws. There are these natural laws out there that God has created. He's put them in nature. We read about them in his scripture, to where man has to operate within certain confines because that's the way we're designed. And you take us and put us in a situation where we're asked to operate outside of that design, we don't work as well because we're not designed that way. It's the same way as if, for example, and this is an analogy that I've used before, I know, but it's like taking a screwdriver and trying to use it as a hammer. It's not going to work as well as a hammer because a hammer is designed to do a hammer's job and a screwdriver is designed to drive screws. You try to use one to do the other, it's not going to work as well because that's not what it was designed to do. And so you are trying to operate outside of your design, and mankind is the same way. God designed man to function a certain way in this world. And anytime we deviate from that, we see problems ensue because mankind is trying to operate in a way in which he was not designed to operate. Socialism seeks to usurp the law and create a utopia here on earth, which was never the purpose of this earth. We're not going to create a perfect world. We're not going to create a perfect society. It cannot be done because that comes later. We had a chance at that in Eden, but we fell, we became sinful, and we got kicked out of Eden. So we have to operate around the natural laws of this world now as we have it. And the reason that I'm bringing that up is because there's a passage in Proverbs 16, 26 through 27. A worker's appetite works for him, for his hunger urges him on. A worthless man digs up evil, while his words are like a scorching fire. So we see this compare and contrast, which is very common in the poetry of the Proverbs, written by Solomon, of course. And we see that this contrast that's given between a worker and the worthless man. You see, since the fall of Adam, ever since the dawn of time, our hunger has served a purpose by motivating us to work. We are hungry, we need sustenance, we need to gather food, we need to figure out a way to remain alive. Therefore, we find some way to produce that food. Now, that could be through actual directly farming, or it could be through providing some service to our fellow man who does farm, and we're able to exchange and trade goods with him. Regardless, the point is, we have to do something productive. We have to produce something of value for our work to be appreciated to the point where someone else is willing to feed us. So some kind of productive work is needed for mankind. This is the way we were designed as people. Because a man will always choose work over starvation, every single time. Nobody ever chooses to starve to death. Now, some people starve to death and they can't help it. They're not able to find those resources. That is a reality, and that is something that we need to deal with. But the point is, nobody ever willingly chooses starvation. And then when good work is done, his body rewards him, both physically and psychologically. Physically, he's rewarded because he feels good, he gets more strength, he gets stronger from a physical standpoint, but he also psychologically is rewarded with a feeling of accomplishment. Endorphins are released in the brain, that kind of thing. So all these things are actively, we as human beings are designed specifically to be the most productive and be the best version of ourselves when we're doing something productive to provide for ourselves. And our body grows stronger so that we can do more work and do that for more reward. Eventually, our work is so productive that it provides for others. That usually comes when a family ensues. So you take care of your wife, you take care of your children, you provide for them. Or if you're, you know, a single mother, you take care of your children. Or, you know, sometimes in modern families, that's reversed. Both parents work. That's okay, too. But the point is, our bodies are able to put out something productive and get a reward in turn for that. Eventually, our work does provide for others, sometimes maybe even through charity, that we're able to give away a portion of that which we have gained to others, and we're also rewarded for that. But work also provides a secondary purpose that I do not think we can overstate the importance of enough. Look at what it says in verse 27. It's contrasting this to the worker. A worthless man digs up evil, and his words are like a scorching fire. So not only does work serve the purpose of doing something productive for ourselves or for our fellow man so that we can get reward from that, but also it provides us a way to stay away from evil. That old saying, idle hands are a devil's workshop, it is definitely not in the Bible, but the principle of that is that when we are not doing what we're supposed to do, that when we're not fulfilling our purpose, that we find evil, that evil seems to seek us out. And that we can be less productive if we're not producing something productively, we'll do something destructive. And so that is part of the thing, that work also serves a purpose by keeping us occupied and keeping us away from doing evil. This is the problem with socialism. Socialism promises food regardless of work or performance. They say you work for us, the government, and then we will provide you food. Because that's what we're supposed to do, because you have a right to food. You have a right to not starve, regardless of what you do. Well, that works against our design. It seeks to remove the incentive to work harder and provide for others as well. And that's part of the problem of socialism, that it does not account for that human nature. It always ends up with plenty of hunger at the end of the day, but no means to satisfy it, just like it did in Venezuela. Oh, they got hunger. Hunger is still there. Hunger is still part of the human condition. What they do is they remove the ability, they remove the incentive for people to move themselves out of that hunger, and as a result, starvation abounds. God wants us to labor for that which we have to help those who cannot do it for themselves. Stay the course, friends.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt. Every weekday from 9 to 11, only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.